Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 164 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Cebulski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. Anti-Semitism was always a part of the Middle Ages, but it flared up most famously and tragically during the Black Death, when Christians in many European towns accused Jews of deliberately poisoning the water supply, executing them in their thousands for a wholly imagined crime. What was it that made this such a powerful conspiracy theory? And how did it start? This week, I spoke with Dr. Tzafrir Barzilai about the phenomenon of well-poisoning conspiracy theories in the 14th century. Tzafrir is a senior lecturer of history at Bar-Ilan University, who works on social, cultural, and religious history in Europe during the 12th to 15th centuries. His work centers around the changing common perceptions of Jews and Christians, especially when it comes to water. His new book is Poisoned Wells, Accusations, Persecutions, and Minorities in Medieval Europe, 1321 to 1422. Our conversation on the evolution of these conspiracy theories, what may have been behind them, and how they were enabled is coming up right after this. Well, thank you, Tzafrir, for coming and talking to us about Poisoned Wells. It's a pleasure to meet you.
You too. Good evening or good afternoon.
Right? Yeah, you're coming to us from Israel and I'm coming to everyone from Toronto. So it is a big difference, but we made it work.
Yes.
Okay, so I think a lot of people have heard about the poison well accusations that were made against Jews during the Black Death. But your book suggests that we go further back in time and further back in space from Germany to understand how these came about. So let's go back in time. What happened in 1321? When it comes to poisoned wells?
Well, poisoning accusations were created not after the Black Death, but in 1321, without direct connection with a major environmental crisis. There was no plague. There was hunger, but it wasn't the most major years of famine in France. And what happened is that there was some kind of political intrigue that pointed towards lepers as people who might be involved in well poisoning accusations. So the first thing that we have to know is that the accusation started with lepers, not with Jews. And the second thing that we have to understand is that they were not connected to any outbreak of leprosy or some kind of water pollution or something that people could see and point at and say there is some kind of an environmental problem. What happened is the political change. Gradually, the nobles of southwestern France and municipal councils of southwestern France became more and more interested in controlling the leper houses, the leprosaria, taking control over these houses that used to be politically autonomous and economically autonomous. And they tried to take over the houses, start managing them, and basically take over their property. But these houses have had a very long tradition of autonomy, and they were defended by the king and by bishops and all kinds of other political actors that protected their privileges. So there was a need, a political need, to create some kind of accusation that would create a political leverage that would allow city councils and lower nobility to take over the leper houses. And that's how the idea of well poisoning came about. And if you think about this idea a little bit, it has to do with infection, infecting the public. And lepers were marked in medieval societies, especially from the second half of the 13th century, as people who might infect society. Not intentionally, of course, but as people who are sick and their disease is very dangerous and infectious, they could infect society or spread disease. If you think about it this way, then the fact that the idea of well poisoning started with lepers rather than with Jews makes a lot of sense. So there is some kind of a cultural background that has to do with disease and leprosy. And there is a political background of there is some kind of a political interest in creating these accusations. And the political interest used or manipulated the cultural idea. And that's how the idea of well poisoning came about.
So we were talking about political interests. If there was a city council or a group of minor nobles that were taking away the rights of the leprosaria, what were they getting out of it?
First of all, they were getting control. One of the things that we see in southern France in the second half of the 13th century, in the early 14th century, is that city councils are trying to take more and more control over different kinds of institutions, political responsibility. They are trying to manage the cities more carefully. And gradually, they are trying to manage the areas around the cities more carefully, be more in charge of taxation, of distribution of lands, of who runs institutions outside of the city. Leper houses are, in medieval cities, are usually outside, right next to the city gate, outside of the city walls. So they are not exactly part of the city, but they are not far away. They are kind of in and out at the same time. And city councils are trying to take control over these institutions that are right next to the city. So that this is part of a larger political movement of, you can call it centralization maybe, or an attempt to gain more political control over the areas around the city. So first of all, control. And second, money. Leper houses have property. They have some real estate. Sometimes they have fields, sometimes they have vineyards, and sometimes they have property. And moreover, they are getting contributions, alms that people give. So this money and property is something that is managed by the leprosaria and sometimes by the lepers themselves. Sometimes they go out and they work in the fields or in the vineyards. The lepers are not completely enclosed in their houses, as we sometimes maybe imagine. And also they are not prevented from, or not completely prevented from, going into the city. So for example, lepers from the leper houses would come to the city and buy food and or other supplies that they might need. So the leper houses are not completely separate from the cities, but they are politically autonomous, at least until 1321, when well poison accusations being invented basically, and they are major political success. So city councils and local lords are able to push these accusations, make them more and more convincing with a series of trials and forced confessions. They're basically forcing the lepers to confess that they poisoned the wells by using torture or threat of torture, a lot of violence. And they take over the houses and they take over the property and they start managing the property that was controlled by the houses themselves before 1321. And they are so successful that the king, Philippe V, is eventually forced to accept these accusations that were not his idea, as some historians suggested. He was not the person who orchestrated the whole thing. It came from below. It came from the local nobility of southwestern France. But it became so popular that the king eventually had to acknowledge it. So in that sense, it was a success because it achieved the political goal that it was invented in order to achieve.
Yeah, and I think this is a really important place to start, situating it as being something that is local, that's not instigated by the church, that's not instigated for religious reasons against a religious minority. It is based around disease, and it's based on a minority that's propertied that you could maybe make what is a quote-unquote credible accusation towards them because of the fears of contagion, right?
Absolutely. But we do have to say that the accusations eventually move to Jews, and maybe we can talk a little bit about why that happens. And Jews are the main victims of the accusations. So there is a first wave in 1321, and in 1321, most of the people accused, tried, executed are lepers. But in 1348 to 1350, during the first outbreak of the Black Death, most of the victims are Jews. And we do have to say that.
Yes.
But even during the Black Death, even when the Jews are the main victims, it doesn't mean that church officials are the one driving the persecution. Even during the Black Death, city councils, nobility are much more involved in promoting well poisoning accusations than bishops, and even more so popes. So popes are pretty consistent in denying well poisoning accusations and rejecting them. It doesn't help, but they try. So not every time that the Jews are being persecuted, it means that church institutions are behind the persecution.
Yes, I wanted to move on to that. I wanted to make sure we laid the groundwork saying this is how it started. But You're absolutely right, of course, that these accusations moved on to accusations against the Jews. Once they had established a good procedure for creating evidence, for creating confessions around this. And one of the things you say in the book is that it's not a natural progression going from people with leprosy to Jews. So how did this come about that these accusations started being directed towards Jews?
I think, again, the main issue is political interest. So the Jews are being expelled from France in 1306. And in 1315, they are being called back for political reasons. They have an important economic role in the economy of medieval France. They provide credit and they allow the kings to earn from indirect taxation. So the Jews would give loans, people would pay back the loans with interest, and the king would tax the Jews a very high amount. And so some of the interest would go to the king. So it's a form of indirect taxation. In 1315, the Jews are being called back, but not all of the nobility of central France are very happy to accept them back. They have to because the king basically forced them to do that. And the Jews are also paying a very high sum to the crown for protection. So they will be able to come back to at least some of the communities that they inhabited before the expulsion. So they return in 1315, and from 1315 to 1321, we see all kinds of incidents involving Jews. So in the south, we mainly see all kinds of complaints that the Jews are engaging in usury, in these credit loans, and the nobility and city councils are complaining that the Jews are extorting money from the Christians. So basically, there is some kind of tension around that. And in the north, we see more violent interactions. So we have one ritual murder accusation. We have attacks against Jews, a synagogue in one place is being, someone breaks into a synagogue. We don't know if it's a criminal activity, it's just robbers, or if there's some kind of accusation around it. But we see more violence or more tension in the north. So at least we know that some of the nobility of France, especially central France, are not happy to have the Jews back. And they're looking for an opportunity to force the king to expel them again. And they're trying all kinds of things, all kinds of accusations or all kinds of arguments against the Jews. And it doesn't work. The kings, especially Philip V, continue to protect the Jews. But in 1321, after well-poisoning accusations are accepted, and as I said, Philip eventually comes to accept the accusations. They become so popular that he acknowledges the accusations against lepers. And after he does that, then the idea of well poisoning is out there. It's basically the king has already agreed that there was well poisoning plot, that the wells had been poisoned. Now it was just a question of bringing the Jews into the story. But this also took some kind of political effort. There was a need to create evidence that the Jews were involved. So a few documents were forged that allegedly showed the connection between the Jews and the lepers who are said to have been poisoned in wells, and the Muslims of the Kingdom of Granada who were said to be behind this whole conspiracy. But in fact, there was no need for the narrative to include the Jews. In the original narrative that developed in, let's say, from April to June 1321, the Jews are not mentioned. So there is a conspiracy. The Muslims are said to be behind it. And the lepers are the one who are accused of poisoning wells and conspiring with the Muslims. Why would the Muslims need a middleman between them and the lepers? It doesn't make sense. But at some point in 1321, once some nobles of central France decide that they want to bring the Jews into the story, then they develop this part of the narrative that talks about the Jews as a middleman between the Muslims and the lepers, and they bring the Jews into the story, and then they can turn well-poisoning accusations against them. But it requires some political action. They need to pressure the king to accept this idea, which takes, I think, a few weeks to do that. And they have to forge all of these documents to bring evidence. So it doesn't happen on its own. There need to be evidence and there need to be some kind of political pressure to force the king to acknowledge that. But it works. He does that and eventually he withdraws his protection of the Jews. We don't know if he actually expelled them again, but he doesn't protect them. And the Jews cannot stay in France without royal protection. So in 1321, they leave again.
I think it's important to mention evidence because many of these are legal proceedings. Charges are brought against Jews in this case, and they need evidence in part because while they are directing the torture to get a confession that implicates the Jews from perhaps someone with leprosy, then they can't actually accept that confession under torture. The person has to confess again later when they're not being tortured, but that is not really enough on its own, right? So they need this evidence.
Yes, and they need the evidence to make sense. They need the stories to corroborate each other. So when we think about medieval courts or medieval institutions, we have the worst image, and partly this is justified. There was torture. There were many people executed. It was horrible. I'm not trying to say anything otherwise. It has some kind of internal logic. And if we want to understand how it came to be that medieval legal institutions put on trial so many people and executed them and took over their property and did all of these things, we have to understand the internal logic of these institutions. How do they find evidence? What kind of evidence they consider reliable and what kind of evidence they dismiss? And this is one of the things that I try to do in the book. So I try to get into the mind of the medieval institutions and show that even when we're discussing something that for us seems so strange, the idea of well-poisoned accusations, even when we're looking at something like that, there is some kind of internal logic to the way these institutions are working. And I try to explain in the book how come they got to the decisions that they end up with and what kind of arguments or stories or narratives they needed in order to justify their actions.
Yeah, I think that's super important to understand because it's not arbitrary, and we can't just dismiss it as being arbitrary, but also it's better to understand that how these mechanisms work so that we can see it happening, we can trace it, and then we can also reflect on it when it comes to our own time. But let's skip forward. So we've established a legal precedent for convicting someone of well poisoning, executing them, taking their stuff. Let's move forward to the Black Death. So how does this start to work when the Black Death starts appearing on the continent of Europe?
Okay, so the first thing that I would like to say is that for 27 years, from 1321 to 1348, well poisoning accusations pretty much disappear. So this idea was popular in 1321. It has two political goals, one to take over the property of the lepers, the other to expel the Jews. It basically did its political job, and then it disappeared because the Jews were expelled from France. Many of the lepers were executed. Much of the property that lepers owned was confiscated and resold to the nobles of southwestern France. So the story is basically over. However, in 1348, once the Black Death arrived, and there is major mortality, maybe 30, 40, 50% in some of the cities, then suddenly the idea of well poisoning makes some kind of sense. Now there is really an environmental crisis. Now there are people dying in very, very high numbers, and no one knows how to explain it. So now the idea of mass poisoning suddenly makes sense. And the accusations reappear exactly when they disappeared in 1321 in southwestern France. So there we find a few cases, but there are no Jews there. The Jews, as I said, were expelled. So the first accusations in 1348 are again against Christians, against marginalized Christians, people of the lower classes, maybe foreigners, people who don't have a lot of social credit, and they are the likely suspects for something like that. So these are the first suspects of 1348. And as the accusations develop, they spread and eventually they arrive to places where there are Jews. And again, through some kind of political action, are being moved from marginalized Christians to Jews. So even in 1348, even though I said that the vast majority of victims in 1348 and after that were Jews, even then, it started with Christians, and there was the need for some kind of political action to tie the idea of well poisoning to Jews again.
Yeah, and what's interesting to note about that is even priests were not exempt from suspicion, right? Because they were traveling around.
Yes, especially mendicants, especially priests who used to walk around from one area to another and preach. They have the perfect excuse. They are walking usually in pairs. No one knows them. They can get from one area to the other, and that's what they do. So people who travel from one area to another and they don't speak the language necessarily and no one knows them are likely to be suspects. So sometimes what creates suspicion is not necessarily religious differences, but differences of geography, language, and if people know you, if there are people in town who trust you and can vouch for you that you are a decent person. So yeah, we have a few cases like that.
Yeah, it's interesting to note, I think, because perhaps we may have an idea that suspicion immediately falls on the Jews, and that's not what happened that you found in your research.
It's not what happens. And also, one of the problem with the scapegoating explanation, that's how historians usually call it, scapegoating. So there is some kind of crisis. We're looking for the weak link who could cause this. And of course, the Jews are the ultimate other, the most notorious enemies of Christianity in medieval perception. And once there is a crisis, there will always be someone to point a finger at the Jews. That's the logic. The problem is that it doesn't explain why in certain areas well poisoning happened and in other areas they didn't. For example, we don't have well poisoning accusations in Italy almost at all. There are many Jews in Italy, and the Black Death devastated Italy, not less or even more than anywhere else in Europe. So why in southern France and not in Italy? Because there is a history of well poisoning accusations in southern France and not in Italy, for example. But if it was only scapegoating, then you would expect to see it in Italy, you would expect to see it in Castile, and it's not there. The evidence doesn't show that it happened. So a general explanation, an explanation that explains everything, is usually a bad explanation.
Yes, that's true. I mean, it's a very complex set of issues always, but especially when it comes to this, right?
Yes. We want to understand medieval society, but the closer we look, the more we see that this is a complicated society like our own. And if we really want to understand how processes came about, we have to look at the local level and try to understand political interests, ideas that were spread in certain areas and not in others, how institutions work. If we want to understand medieval society, we have to be willing to do that and get our hands dirty and read the sources in all of the languages that they are written in and try to put the puzzle together. And that's how we can start answering questions like, why were there no well poisoning accusations in Italy, even though there was plague and there were Jews?
Right. And one of the places where I think it's most notorious and some of the most terrible atrocities happened was in the German Empire. So why do you think it centered all these accusations and the horrible atrocities that followed? Why do you think those kind of clustered around the German Empire?
As I said, they started in Southern Europe. But in the German Empire, there were still very, very large Jewish communities. This was not the case, not in France and not in England. It was the case in Italy. So in the German Empire, there were Jews, and there is a history of anti-Jewish sentiment and anti-Jewish activities starting in the late 13th century and through the first half of the 14th century. And one of the reasons is that there is political instability and the emperor or the king of Germany take a step back from protecting local Jews. So the more violence being directed against them, the more the emperors actually take a step back and don't want to take the political struggle of protecting the Jews. So Germany was more vulnerable in that sense. So when the idea of well poisoning arrived to Germany in 1348, and the plague arrived a little later, but there is already rumors about the plague. So there is a rumor about this mass mortality, and the idea of well poisoning just arrives. And there is political instability, and the king is not willing or is unable to protect the Jews. Then you have the perfect storm. And this is what I think happened in the German Empire.
Yeah, I think it is the perfect storm. And it's worth mentioning that people didn't immediately believe that conclusion. They had to work very hard to quote unquote prove that this was happening.
They proved it basically in the same way. Gathered Jews, they put them on trial, they tortured them, they extracted these confessions. Then they start circulating these confessions, send them from one city to the other. But even when they do that, not every local administration necessarily buys the story. In Cologne, for example, they have a very, very large Jewish community and they they ask around whether well poisoning accusations are reliable, and they basically send letters to different city councils around them or in the Rhineland in general, and they keep getting the answer, yes, we convicted the Jews for well poisoning, and they are not convinced because they know these systems better than we do. They know that at least some of these confessions are forced. They have their own suspicions. So even in the worst time of anti-Jewish persecution, not everyone buys the story. Different people, different institutions, different officials have their own ideas. And we always have to remember that there is no one formula that works for every community, that works for every place. It's more complicated than that.
Yeah, and I think it's really important, especially if you're thinking about the scapegoating argument, that the Pope himself issues a decree saying this is not Jewish poisoning. This is not what's happening. So everyone should just stop persecuting them. It is not their fault. And that's coming from the highest point of Christianity.
Yes, but people don't always listen to the Pope.
That's right.
And people, city councils, lords, they have their own interests. And when we start looking at specific cities and try to analyze the internal politics of each city, we see that there are all kinds of political tensions that were there before the Black Death. And usually well poisoning accusations are being used, or in some cases at least, they're being used as some kind of leverage in these struggles. So if the council tried to back the Jews, then the opposition would take the position of well poisoning accusation as a way to undermine the political position of the ruling council. So sometimes it has to do with political struggles, with political interests, with all kinds of conversations that are not necessarily about religion. And okay, yes, so the Pope said it's not true, but this is not a conversation necessarily about religion. It's a conversation about local politics. So why would we care what the Pope has to say about that?
Yeah, it's true. It's true. I was just trying to gesture at the fact that it's very complicated and it's not just a simple religious issue, right? Well, one of the examples that you say is probably the most famous example is Strasbourg. So can you walk us through what happened in Strasbourg?
So what happens in Strasbourg is that before the Black Death in 1332, there is a change of government. And the old council that was held by the higher nobility and supported by the bishop is being replaced by a council that is held by lower nobility and the guilds, basically, very roughly. So there is a new council that is basically pushed away or pushed to the side a little bit at the higher nobility and the bishop that used to be very, very strong in Strasbourg. And they are somehow trying to control the city. And they are able to do that until 1349. And then the Black Death appears and they have a major social crisis on their hands. And the more the crisis continues, the more rumors about the plague arrive and the more rumors about well poisoning accusations arrive in Strasbourg, the more they have a problem to keep their unstable government in place. There is more and more popular backlash against the Jews. And what happens is that the higher nobility and the bishop are actually taking the side of the people and backing well poisoning accusation in order to undermine the council. And they are able to do that. What happens eventually is that there is an uprising. They get rid of the council that was being supported by the guilds and the lower nobility. And a new council that is based on the higher nobility and the lower artisans is taking the place of the old council. And then the Jews are being executed. So there is some kind of a political struggle for about 6 months before the Jews are being executed. And the execution of the Jews is basically the outcome of this political revolution. So if we want to understand the persecution of Jews, we have to understand local politics. Otherwise, we have no way of making sense of any of this.
Yeah. And Strasbourg was one of the cities that was asking for information from city after city. They were asking for what are the results of your trials and your trials and your trials. And so far, they hadn't made any ruling against the Jews until they were overturned. Is that right?
Yes. I think what happens in Strasbourg is that the council is trying, they can't ignore well poisoning accusations. It's all over the place. People are moving, people are talking. You can't ignore it. So they open an investigation. It doesn't mean that they want to finish the investigation with some kind of outcome. They just want to delay conversation about this. So they start an investigation, and they investigate people and they ask for information and they gather this information. And maybe they're hoping that this crisis will just resolve itself. But it doesn't work. The Black Death becomes more and more real. There are more and more rumors, and eventually the plague reaches the German Empire and they can't avoid the subject anymore. So they're trying to basically stall, but they're unable to do that. And in the end, there is this popular revolt and the mayor, the head of the council, had to flee town. And that's the end of the protection for the Jews.
I think that, again, if we come back to the scapegoating argument, that it's often based on popular uprisings. So the ones that you see in Cologne and perhaps Strasbourg, but that's not what you found to be most of the cases, right?
Yes. So I think there is some kind of a popular element. So rumors are important, but it's not that in every town, the lower classes are always the one who are anti-Jewish. There is no one class that is always anti-Jewish or is always involved in popular revolts. And also, usually, even when there is some kind of popular uprising, it's very often directed by the bishop, higher nobility, other political agents who has some kind of interest to change the political situation. So even something like a popular uprising, it's very often has some kind of political background and other political agents who are muddling, who are spreading the ideas, who are supporting the lower artisans who we usually don't even know their names, who are involved in the uprising.
Yes, people with an agenda who are stirring up popular sentiment against a minority is not something that is unfamiliar to us, I think.
Yes, I'm not going to refer to anything that happened after the Middle Ages. I'm not an expert and I don't want to be. There is enough to work with in 14th century Europe.
Yes, absolutely. Okay, but let's get to the afterlife. After the Black Death, though, you noticed a huge drop off in accusations of well poisoning. So what happens after the Black Death?
After the Black Death, there are a few things that happen. First of all, the Black Death didn't stop with one outbreak. So the Black Death keep returning all over Europe every, let's say, 7 to 12 years. So about every decade, you have a new outbreak of the Black Death in different parts of Europe. And this continues throughout the Middle Ages and into the early modern period, all the way to the late 17th century. So the Black Death doesn't disappear. And what it means for well poisoning accusations is that even cities that got rid of their Jews or other minorities still experience the Black Death again and again and again and again. So it's very clear that the Black Death was not caused by well poisoning. The other thing that happens is that the more this happens, the less political leverage there is that can be linked to well poisoning accusation. So when there is something new like the Black Death, some kind of a crisis, then in the first stages, when things are most unstable, then there is the potential for a lot of political changes and a lot of political maneuvers to take place. The more the Black Death becomes something that is familiar, the less political leverage there is to well poisoning accusations. So the idea is still there, but once you take away the political action, then you don't see that many acts of persecution and violence. There is some, especially in the areas where well poisoning accusations were the most popular. So the Rhineland, mostly the southern Rhineland around Alsace, there you find more well poisoning accusations. But by the early 15th century, they disappear even there.
Yeah, and I think that pointing to the fact that there isn't credible evidence anymore, and again, like quote unquote credible evidence, really pushes against that case that they might be trying to bring against minorities.
Yes, but we also have to remember that after the minorities, and this doesn't just include Jews, it includes also converts or all kinds of foreigners. After they're being persecuted during the first outbreak of the Black Death, many cities either kill their Jews or expel them. So the political problem or the political tension around Jews reduces because they're not there anymore. So there is less of a political incentive to act against them also for that reason.
You have noticed, though, that this is something, an accusation that sticks to Jewish people when it comes to literature or anecdotes that people are talking about later, right?
Yes, I think this has to do more with the literature that were created in the 15th and 16th century than with the actual reality of well poisoning accusations. So yes, in the end, Jews were the main victims, and this is what we find in chronicles and in literary presentation of well poisoning accusations. But in fact, there were also other victims, there were Christian victims. And in 1321, most of the victims were obviously the lepers. And even in 1348, the first victims were Christians. But when historians of the 15th and the 16th century are writing about it, or poets, or all kinds of popular literature, they use the Jews as a symbol. They use them to play a role in the narrative. They don't necessarily represent the reality of the 14th century as it was. So the image that we have when we look from the 21st century is very much influenced by the development of literature in the 15th and 16th centuries. And I try to avoid that. I try to build the book chronologically and for each chapter only write about the very contemporary sources, sources that were written during the time of the crisis itself, and even ignore sources that were written even a few years later. Or not ignore them, but put them aside and treat them much more critically. And this is how I was able to create something new than what existed in historical literature before. Because if you try to take all of the evidence together and not consider what was written during the time of the crisis and what was written in retrospect, then you get a very confusing picture.
It's true. So I'm glad you wrote this book and got into the complexity. And I'm hoping that when people continue to write about the Black Death or about this 14th century and its persecutions, that they look at your work and realize that it's a very complex. It's a very complex topic. Yes, I hope they look at your work. I hope lots more people will look at your work after this podcast. Thank you so much for coming on and talking to me about poisoned wells.
Thank you for having me.
To find out more about Safrir's work, you can visit his academia.edu page at haifa.academia.edu/Safrir Barzilai. His book is Poisoned Wells, Accusations, Persecutions, and Minorities in Medieval Europe, 1321-1422. Before we go, here's Peter from medievalist.net to tell us what's been going on the last month. How's it going, Peter?
Hey, it's been going pretty good. I'm back in Canada after about 3 weeks in the UK.
Yeah, and you were at a couple of conferences, right? You were at a Crusades conference, and you were also at the International Medieval Congress in Leeds, right?
That's right. First, I was at Royal Holloway, which is just outside of London, for the Society for the Study of the Crusades and Latin East conference. That's a mouthful. And this is a conference I really, really enjoyed. It comes around every 4 years and it got delayed for a couple of years because of the pandemic. But it's like all the kind of big crusade scholars in the world gather for that. And these are a lot of people I've read their articles and books over the years and have been fascinated. So it's a chance to meet a lot of them and rub shoulders with giants, right?
They say you should never meet your heroes, but you had a great time meeting your heroes, right?
I did. And this was one of the best conferences I think I've ever been to. A 4-day conference, lots of great papers, kind of switching between plenary type papers where just one speaker talks for about an hour. And then you have like the kind of regular sessions. Everyone gets like a 20-minute talk and stuff like that. So it was a real nice mix and a lot of fascinating stuff for me there.
I'm glad. And I'm sure you're going to be telling us more about it on the website. How is Leeds?
Well, Leeds was excellent as usual. And again, you know, it's nice to meet up with friends and colleagues that you haven't seen in a couple of years. And the conference is, again, always really well organized because you have 3,000 people, jam them all into sessions. It's very much like a morning to nighttime kind of deal where you're always listening to papers and just scoot into the bookstore for the sales there. And the theme was borders. So that was a lot of really good topics and a lot of more international topics. So that's really good too. So quite a good time.
Yeah, Leeds is always super well organized and there's so many great people there. And you actually gave a paper at each conference, right? How'd it go?
Oh, hey, well, you know, no one threw stuff at me. So I talked about the Crusades and YouTube. Looking for, say, the First Crusade, what actually you find when going on YouTube, the good, bad, and ugly. At Leeds, I was in a round table on being a public figure, talking about, you know, how to reach out to the wider audience related to the Middle Ages. And I also talked about Patreon, right? Because, you know, we do it fairly well here, I think. And I wanted to show other people, hey, this is perhaps a chance for you to help you out in your careers.
Yes.
Yeah, I was really glad to talk about both those topics.
Well, I mean, always shout out to the Patreon patrons, because not only are they making it possible for me to do this stuff, but also other people at medievalist.net too. So it's awesome. Yeah, I'm glad that you were able to talk about Patreon and spread the word.
Indeed, indeed. Yeah, it was good to talk about that and talked with other people that use Patreon. And that really gave me some ideas as well on how to do that, make it even better. So,
So we're going to see some exciting stuff coming up on Patreon.
Indeed, indeed.
And what's new on the website this week? Are you just giving us your thoughts on the last few weeks of your international jet setting?
We've got a couple of pieces that are really interesting, and I'm about to work on them tonight, so they'll be out by the time this podcast comes out. One is by Joel Rollo Coster, and it's about elections, medieval elections, in particular the ones for the papacy, and how the one that happened in 1378 kind of led to the Great Schism. 40 years of problems, so for the church. And there's a lot of parallels with, you know, what's happening today, you know. So I thought it was a really good piece. So I'm encouraged with that. And also Mike Horswell has been writing about the Crusades in the modern sense, like a modern form, how the word and the idea was revived in the 19th and early 20th centuries and how it's come along into the 21st. Everything from opera to video games and like where it kind of leaves us today. So I thought that was a really good piece too. So I wanted to highlight that. Plus, we've got stuff like Chinggis Khan's missing 10 years, and we've got some news about Matthew of Paris.
Wow. Wow. So you have not been sleeping on the job while you've been away.
Well, I did a lot of sleeping on the job and traveling and stuff like that. So I'm trying to catch up for it now.
Well, there's lots of stuff there. And one of the things that's going to be there is an article that is going to be written by me, an interview with this woman called Laura Careless, who is doing a one-woman show called She Wolves at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. And I mean, it's based on Helen Castor's work, She Wolves, the women who ruled England before Elizabeth. And I mean, I am going to be a Helen Castor stan for my entire life. And I also really love the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, where I actually performed 20 years ago. So I have a soft spot in my heart for both of these things. But Laura Careless reached out to say she's performing this show. It's based on Helen Castor's work. So it's going to be quite good, I think. And it's going to be incorporating dance and song and the stories of five queens, including Empress Matilda, Eleanor of Aquitaine, Isabella of France, Margaret of Anjou, and Mary the First. So that's going to be really good. So if anybody is in or around Scotland in August, I mean, always go to the Fringe Festival. This particular show is going to be from the 5th to the 13th of August at 6:40 p.m. at Greenside Nicholson Square, which is right in the heart of Edinburgh itself. So I can't make the show, but I hope someone else will make it and tell us all about it. And in the meantime, I'm going to be telling everyone about it on medievalist.net in an article that they can check out.
Very cool. Very cool. Thanks so much.
Yeah, it's going to be awesome. Well, thanks for catching up with me, Peter. I'm so glad you had a great trip. And thanks for telling us all about it.
Well, thanks.
Thank you, as always, to medievalist.net's patrons on patreon.com. Patrons can sign up for all sorts of great rewards like subscriptions to the Medieval Magazine and Medieval World Magazine, as well as ad-free versions of medievalist.net and exclusive maps by Tina Ross. If you're enjoying this podcast, please consider signing up for Patreon, as your patronage directly funds both my podcast and others hosted by medievalist.net. If you're already a patron, rest assured you have my undying gratitude. Thanks. For everything from wells to bells, follow medievalist.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalists. You can find me, Danielle Cebulski, across social media at 5MIN Medievalist or 5-Minute Medievalist. And you can find my books at all your favorite bookstores, where you can get hold of How to Live Like a Monk, Medieval Wisdom for Modern Life, in hardcover, ebook, and audiobook. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thanks for listening, and have yourself an amazing day.